Welcome to the WP Tonic This Week in WordPress and SaaS podcast, where Jonathan Denwood interviews the leading experts in WordPress, e-learning, and online marketing to help WordPress professionals launch their own SaaS.
Welcome back, folks, to the WP Tonic Show This Week in WordPress and SaaS. And in this week, we got a great special guest. We got Justin Chan from Pitvu with us. It's a SaaS-based business. It helps you do surveys to your clients or potential users to find out how they think of your copy, your design, anything to do with any product or service that you're trying to pitch to the general public or to business to business. Should be a great discussion. We're going to be talking about all the things that Justin has learned in trying to build this business, some of the things that came on the radar that he wasn't expecting, and we're going to be talking about AI. It's going to be a fantastic discussion. I'm going to let Justin do a really quick 10-15 second intro. So Justin, would you like to quickly introduce yourself to the tribe?
Sure. My name is Justin Chen, the co-founder of Pitvu. I've been an entrepreneur since 2006, so I won't even try to do the math on that, but it's been a long time. And I've been running fully remote companies and building them for, you know, the past, whatever it is, 18 years.
Bit like me, really, but there we go. I've got my great co-host, Kurt. Kurt, would you like to introduce yourself to the new listeners and viewers?
Sure thing, Jonathan. My name is Kurt Von Onen. I own a agency called Manana No Mas, a podcast with the same name, and we focus on membership and learning websites.
That's fantastic. And before we go into the meat and potatoes of this great show, I've got a couple messages from our major sponsors. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
Tired of hosting providers that can't handle high traffic loads? Convessio is here to help. Our platform can handle any amount of traffic, all without slowdown or crashing. With immediate Slack support, performance optimization, and a team that thrives on resolving technical challenges, your e-commerce business is in safe hands. Learn more about Convessio at convessio.com.
Hi there, tribe. It's Jonathan here, and I want to tell you about OmenSend. OmenSend is a great plugin that delivers SMS messaging and email messaging to your clients. If you're building a woo solution for your client and you're looking to provide a SMS functionality for them and great email, why don't you look at OmenSend? Got a great special deal. You can go to wp-tonic.com/deals and they're offering 30% off the first 3 months. Plus, if you need any technical help or a migration, they're offering almost $1,000 to help migrate if you've got a group of clients that are looking for this type of service. It's a great offer. They're a great company. I highly recommend them to you. So, like I say, go over to the deals page on the WP Tonic website and you'll find more details there. Speak to you soon, folks. Bye. We're coming back, folks. I want to point out that we got some great special offers from the sponsors, plus a curated list of the best WordPress plugins and services that will save you a ton of time if you're a WordPress professional. You can get all these goodies by going over to wp-tonic.com/deals. wp-tonic.com/deals. What more could you ask for, beloved tribe? Probably a lot more, but that's all you're going to get from that bloody page. Sorry to disappoint. I've made a career of it. So let's go into it. Justin's already looking puzzled. I can guarantee, Justin, by the end of this show, you're going to look a lot more puzzled. So, Justin, Maybe you can give some more detailed information. So how did you get into the world of entrepreneurship and trying to build digital companies? It's a crazy part of the world. How did you get into it? And also, what led to you seeing opportunity with Pitfood?
Sure. So going way back, my co-founder and I, we both met each other in college. We were both in computer science. But we graduated during the dot-com bust of 01. And so we went the big corporate route. He went to Microsoft, I went to Hewlett Packard, and we kind of just, you know, did the easier corporate route for a number of years. But we always had this entrepreneurial bug that we wanted to do something. And so we finally got together in 2006 and just quit our jobs. We wanted to run some kind of business. We weren't sure what it was. It could have been a restaurant, a bar, a website, like anything. Like we literally had a whiteboard of the craziest ideas we could think of. And we just decided to build a restaurant review website. And so we quit the next week. And, you know, there was no code, nothing was written. It was literally a legal Zoom incorporation and just, you know, kind of went cold turkey. So we did that for a couple of years. And along the way, we were doing a redesign for that website. And we wanted to get feedback on which design to use. And by that point, it had already been a couple of years. We had asked our friends and family a million questions to that point. And, you know, they start to get sick of it. They start giving you like answers like, oh, you know best, and you know whatever you choose is going to be fine. And so, you know, we've all heard these kinds of answers from our friends and family. So we decided to build our own digital focus group service as a side project. And that's where Pitfood was born back in 2008. And it was a side project that we threw up on Hacker News, and you could still find the original post on there. And we just launched it, put it out there for other entrepreneurs to use, and just kind of watched to see how it would evolve from there.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how long did it take before you started to get any, what you consider any traction in the company? How long did it take you to get the wheel actually moving to any extent?
Yeah, it took a long time because we weren't treating it like a business, I guess. It was a very low price. We put it out there. And the first big user we had was actually Gabriel Weinberg of DuckDuckGo. And he wrote a really nice blog post about how he was using it to do some validation. And so that was really nice confirmation that we were on the right track. But our initial target market, we thought was just going to be other entrepreneurs like ourselves, like very bootstrapped, which is great. And we always wanted to support that community. But like, you know, we're all kind of cheap and we all don't want to spend a ton of money. So not really the best audience for monetization. But what was interesting as we slowly evolved the product based off customer feedback, and we started seeing people outside of entrepreneurship using it. So we had a lot of authors using it, self-publishing authors testing book titles and book covers. And, you know, by that point, Tim Ferriss had popularized, you know, using data to choose your book title. That's how he chose 4-Hour Workweek. And so there was a large community of book marketers talking about it, about using it to test that kind of stuff before you publish your book, before you launch, especially if you didn't have an editor or publisher that could guide you along the way. And so it was a very interesting path as we started seeing different customer segments using the platform. And then we would try marketing to them. We would try to tailor the service a little bit. And then, you know, it was a very good learning experience to see which customer segments were not only good customers, but attainable, I guess. Like, you know, you need to be able to reach them in a scalable way. So we also started seeing mobile game companies use us. Some really large ones were using us, but then those were really difficult to find, right? Because they were more of a sales process and we just weren't ready or equipped to handle that at that time. So as we evolved this product over, you know, 8 years, as a side project, it finally took hold in the e-commerce space, and selling online, selling on Amazon, selling in different marketplaces really started taking off back in 2018, 2019. And that's where we found a target customer that had a lot of repeat usage. We were providing value because we were helping them make money. We were helping them de-risk their investments. And so there was a much better alignment with the business. And then also from a marketing standpoint, they were easier to reach than say like mobile game companies, because there was a tighter community of people learning about e-commerce and talking about selling on Amazon and things like that. And so that's when we really started to grow. That's when we decided to pivot all of our attention from our previous business over to PicFu and really start scaling the team and kind of going for it, so to speak.
So I think what you're describing is a lot of people, and I've learned myself this road of market fit, finding the right audience.
That's right.
That is also available in a timeline that the cost of acquiring that customer isn't ridiculous to the price of the product.
Yeah, yeah. Because in the beginning, when we thought authors were going to be a great market for us, they're still great. It's a great use case for them. But the acquisition cost and then the amount that they would use it just wasn't matching up, right? Because maybe you'll write a book once a year if you're prolific, probably just once in your life. And so you're going to use it a few times and that's great. But then, you know, you're no longer a repeat user for us. Whereas if you're selling products, you might be selling a dozen or more products at a given time. And so you're constantly working on new designs or packaging or logos or branding or marketing imagery, all that kind of stuff. So there's always more things to test that could actually just improve your revenue as a customer in the e-commerce space and gaming as well, which is still a big segment for us. So we definitely have honed in on like those two markets as the ones where we think there's the best product market fit.
That's fantastic. Over to you, Kurt.
Well, I'm just kind of curious as my brain's swimming around. Like I think of it, I've worked with a lot of marketing people in the past. And so marketing people typically say, well, let's throw it up on an A-B test. And then none of them know how to run an A-B test. You know, run around the office or let's release the page this way and this way and see what gets the most hits or whatever. And it seems like you guys have just simplified that kind of process, like throw a mock-up of this and a mock-up of that. And what do people pick? And then now you can go into production and make something instead of sitting around with your hands folded, waiting to see what marketing says.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're trying to make it easier to test hypothetical situations and allow people who don't have any experience doing this kind of market research do it. So we try to make it simple. You basically come to the site, you ask a question, which design would you prefer or which product would you like to buy? Like you said, you could put up two different mockups. It could be two different packaging designs, two different logos, or, you know, 2 to 8 different logos. It could be your product against your competitor. Maybe it's in the marketplace. Maybe you've got your app icon versus like your other solitaire games that you're trying to compete with. And we're going to go find the audience for you. We're going to make sure that they're high quality and they're incentivized. And then they're going to vote on which ones they like. But more importantly, they're going to give you written explanations why. And that's where the real nuggets of insight are. And also a differentiation from live A-B testing, because you may see which one wins quantitatively, but you're not going to understand why they chose it. You might have assumptions, but when people just tell you like, I don't like that font, change it, or, you know, green doesn't work for this kind of product, then you know exactly what to have, what to change on the next iteration. And so what we'll see, because it's so fast, it also takes like 15, 30 minutes to get this kind of feedback. We'll see the designer sit down and just iterate throughout the day, making changes based off the feedback. And then, you know, within a day, you could come to a confirmed better product than what you had at the start of the day.
So to kind of bounce off of what you and Jonathan were talking about, you were talking about product market fit and things like that. Is there like an action for you and your team to be like, oh, real estate's starting to suck right now. We should go help a team of like, we should reach out to realtors to try and do A-B testing on curb appeal or.
Oh, you definitely don't want to do that, Justin.
Or, you know, the automotive industry, you know, EVs now seem to be suffering in sales, right? So maybe car manufacturers would be someone to approach that says, oh, should these EVs be released in more colors than just white, silver, and black?
Yeah.
You know, it's I just think as I think about industries that come up against these, their obstacles, right? When they hit their plateaus, your service could be a really good leapfrog service to kind of re-inject, you know, that sinking market.
I think there's always ideas of other markets that we could tackle, but I think for now we feel the opportunity is large enough in the two that we decided to focus on. So e-commerce and specifically mobile gaming. So I think until we've hit, you know, the critical mass that we want to see there, we're not going to do a strong expansion into other markets. And I think even within those, I think there's differentiations in the ideal customer profile that, you know, for example, why we focus on mobile gaming versus, let's say, like AAA games, like the Call of Duty kind of thing, because the iteration cycle of a mobile game is much faster. And typically mobile game companies will have larger portfolio of games to work on. And for us, like as a usage-based company, that's really the name of the game. And so the same with someone selling on Amazon versus someone who's selling like a single product on their Shopify store, where there's not as many decisions anymore, right? I've already established a brand. Here's the product. I don't have a tons of different variations or lines. But if I'm selling something on a marketplace, I'm probably doing more of a numbers game. I've got a lot of different product lines. I got a lot of different variations, a lot of different marketing assets to test. So as we consider other market segments, that's something that we keep in mind now that we better understand what's going to work well for the business. And then, you know, to the point about realtors, they could be an interesting, you know, we do have people testing Airbnb, main images, things like that. But then it comes down to, you know, how hard is it going to be to acquire those? What's the repeat usage? And then also kind of how B2C are they as a customer? Because the more consumer-like they are, the harder. If they're too much like a consumer mindset, they're a little bit more difficult, as you know, a lot of you guys probably know.
Like, we don't want anything about difficult people.
The more business-minded they can be as a customer, then they're going to understand value propositions and you know, be willing to spend money versus like someone who is like an amateur business person, I guess.
Nice. Well, that kind of hits on what your ideal target market group is, but my question was supposed to be, what are the major problems that Pickful really helps solve for the client?
Yeah, so it's really de-risking decisions and you know, having information before you launch. So a lot of times we'll have customers come to us before they've made a huge investment in something. So on the gaming side, that could be as they're building a game, they're testing out game concepts, they're testing out character designs, even UX. And sometimes it's a gameplay, hypothetical gameplay against their competitors, trying to see what's going to be interesting. On the product side, it might be testing out product designs that they're trying to see if it's going to be better than the competition. Maybe they're trying to test out variations of different products. And, you know, we'll get feedback that like, hey, I thought I was going to order 8 different colors of journals, but it really came back that people only wanted purple or whatever it is. So I only bought purple. And that's great. And it sold out because now you're not stuck with, oh, I'm trying to get rid of like the weird orange color and I'm marking it half price on Amazon because like no one wants to buy it. And just making sure that they're not losing money. So really de-risking investment is the major problem that we're solving for people. And things like books, you know, like books and products, like once you put it out there, like there's no live testing it. There's no like rapid iteration. It's not digital. So really making sure you hit it right from the very beginning is important.
Good. Thanks. Jonathan, back to you.
Yeah, just a quick to follow what you just said. Did it take you a while to work out what your product really was doing for its target audience?
Yeah. It took a lot of customer conversations to understand, you know, the fact that we were giving them more confidence, that we're there, they were making these decisions. Because when we see them come through, we don't really have the context of, like, what is it that they're testing? And so, you know, as every business owner should be doing, like, you should be talking to your customers. And so when we hop on the phone with them and they give us the context, oh, actually, I was, you know, trying to decide before an order. Or on the gaming side, what was really interesting is we thought they were just optimizing out of the gate app icons. A lot of times what we hear is that, oh, we actually soft launched into a different country. It failed horribly. And so we came back and now we were like doing testing and iteration to try to improve the odds for the next time we either soft launch or do our main launch into the country that we want to. So really interesting to get the context from talking to customers and just watching how they use it to tailor their product. I think a lot of times as builders, we all have like an idea of how we want people to use it. And that's not always how they want to use it. And so, you know, having that mental flexibility to talk to them, like, okay, well, you know, first of all, I do agree that they are the ideal customer, and I do want to build them that way, and just being open to adapting it. And then even broader, I guess, you know, we didn't know what we were building in the very beginning. We just knew we had an itch to scratch.
Well, you had kind of, I wouldn't say a vision, but you had a plan.
Yeah.
But it can only be, unless you're really in that industry, you're one of those target users.
Yeah.
It's educated guessing to some extent. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, it is educated guessing. But I think as you, again, as you talk to your customers and get confirmation that you're heading in the right direction, I think what was interesting to us was, as we started discovering this broad need for rapid consumer feedback across different customer segments, and then as we started getting larger customers, you know, we have a lot of corporate customers now using it, which we always thought was puzzling because they have consumer insights teams. Like, we have very large, some of the largest companies in the world using us. And, you know, we always ask them, like, why don't you just tap into the insights team that you have? And they'll tell us, well, insights teams won't give us the time of day for these kinds of tests because they run the big studies, right? Like, if we're, what's the strategy around like this next big product push or something like that? And it's a very long form, takes, you know, five figures at least and maybe a couple months. But if I just want to test out packaging variation, they're not going to help me out. And we don't have the tools to do that. So really enabling everyone in any kind of enterprise to gather feedback. So basically getting into the hands of the people doing the work. So the marketers, the designers, the product managers, has really empowered a lot of people. And so we saw this untapped area of, you know, democratized market research. And that's what our goal is. Like, our broader goal is just to make it so that anyone can do this kind of research, whether you're a small publisher, which will, you know, author that will still handle, or a product manager at, you know, a Fortune 500 company.
So if you don't want me, are you totally bootstrapped or are you angel VC?
Fully bootstrapped. Yeah, we were able to build it with the revenue from our previous business. And then as we started seeing the growth, then we just started reinvesting profits into hiring.
Well, that's fantastic. So what are a couple of the major things you've learned the hard way through this, was it 8 to almost 10 year journey with PitFu? What are a couple of the most surprising things you've learned on this journey that you didn't anticipate?
Well, we definitely didn't anticipate all the different industries and customer segments we were going to get into. So I think that's been interesting. Definitely authors caught us for a loop at the very beginning. Seeing, you know, game companies test out Super Bowl commercials was amazing. And then helping really large, you know, CPG companies test actual products that see, you know, the retail shelves is really awesome. So I think that's been really amazing. I think for us also, the global nature of our customer base has been really fascinating. So we started with a US specific pool of respondents. And so that actually ended up attracting a lot of non-US customers. So if you're a Chinese game company or a Chinese manufacturer and you want to get US customer feedback, you know, it makes sense. Or you're in Europe selling it to the US, you're LATAM selling it to the US. So, you know, we still have about 50% of our customers outside the US. And so that's guided us to build a much more global workforce. So we want to make sure that the people, our whole team that's building this product for, you know, a global customer base, always has different cultural considerations in mind when we're building UI or writing copy and making sure things can be localized and all that kind of stuff. And so I think that was definitely unexpected, but I think has really allowed us to build a more interesting company. So now we've got people all over the place, from South Africa, the Kazakhstan, to LATAM, to Greece and Pakistan. So pretty awesome. And I think, you know, that was kind of pre-pandemic that we started seeing that trend and, you know, continue to ride that totally global and remote workforce.
So you've got these pool of individuals that give feedback. How do you get these individuals? And they've got, what is the right type of individual to do this type of feedback? Because you could say, oh, it's just anybody, but it isn't really. Because, you know, I'm only surmising this, that it's particular. Did that take a long time to find the right pool of people and attract the right people?
So we tap into the same. There's a whole industry of companies that explicitly build what they call consumer panels. And so we tap into the same consumer panels that a Procter & Gamble would use when they do their market research. But the way they will do it is their insights team will work with an external market research consultant who will then go, you know, work with these panels and, you know, create these long form surveys. They'll collect a bunch of data. They'll do a bunch of manual data quality cleaning and compile the results. And we try to automate all of that into like a more simplistic single question approach. So we're not going out and sourcing the people as much as partnering with different panels.
Oh, right.
And then we build a layer of our own data quality and audience targeting on top of all of those. And the quality is definitely the biggest challenge and where we spend the most time. Because as you can imagine, if you incentivize people on the internet to do something, they're going to try to game the system. So we spend a lot of
that. They would never do that, Justin. That shocks me, Justin. That really does. That insight shocks. I'm sorry, bit of sarcastic English humor.
Yeah. So we spend a lot of our effort pruning quality and try to improve the way that we reject people. So, you know, on a given poll of 50 responses, we're probably rejecting over half of those. As we're able to detect if they're not paying attention or they're just not doing it earnestly. And by asking for that written explanation, that gives us an important data point for, you know, kind of gauging that kind of engagement. And so if you were just buying traffic to your, you know, live A/B test and people are just like randomly clicking, like, well, you don't know, like, if they actually meant that. But if you ask them to explain it, like, at least they're forced to give some, you know, some thought to it.
Yeah, before we go for our break then, so you said it's all been bootstrapped. You know, one of the linked to this question, do you think that was the right decision? Do you think you should have taken investment at an earlier stage? Would it have really helped in accelerating this process, or are you totally happy with your decision to just bootstrap it?
I don't think it would have. I think it would have steered us down the wrong path. I'm happy with the slower evolution because I think we built up so much, I guess, knowledge from the content iteration and kind of probing different directions. And I feel like if we were funded, we would have picked one of those from the very beginning and just gone super hard in that direction. Even if the unit economics maybe didn't make as much sense, it would have been like, do it at scale, even if you were losing money kind of thing. And I think it would have put us in a really bad place. And our previous business was also self-funded. And, you know, we saw a lot of our competitors be forced to shut down or forced to pivot their business model just because, like, well, the board and investors say that, like, it's not working out. But from the outside and from our perspective, we always thought, like, no, that's a great business. Like, why are they changing it? Like, they had a good thing going and, you know, it's just that it wasn't good enough, right? It wasn't big enough. And so they had to just keep taking like wild stabs at different things. And eventually a lot of them just shut down. And so we didn't want that to happen to this business. And we wanted to allow it to have the natural evolution that would give it stronger legs in the long run. And it's just allowed us to build it the way we want to build it. I don't, you know, even going fully global, I think would have been a challenge in the very beginning. I think, they would have forced us to be in the same location and have an office, you know, if this was like 8 to 10 years ago. And my business partner and I have never been in the same place. We've always been in two different cities across the 18 years that we've worked together. So,
why you can keep working together for 18 years, isn't it?
Yeah, we're not bothering each other.
Sounds like the perfect marriage. Sorry, now I'm getting into trouble now. We're going to go for our break, folks. It's been a fantastic discussion with Justin. I think we've covered some good stuff. We've got some good questions for the second half. We've got a couple more messages from our great sponsors. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Lifter LMS. the leading learning management system solution for WordPress. If you or your client are creating any kind of online course, training-based membership website, or any type of e-learning project, Lifter LMS is the most secure, stable, well-supported solution on the market. Go to lifterlms.com and save 20% at checkout with coupon code podcast20. That's podcast20. Enjoy the rest of your show.
We're coming back, folks. It's been a great discussion. I think Justin's actually warming to my English humor. He's grinning. He's not scowling. But before we go into the other questions, I want to point out we've got a great weekly newsletter aimed at the WordPress community. To get this great rag, which I write myself, I scour the internet for you, beloved tribe, finding the latest tech and WordPress stories that interest me. Plus, I write a little commentary in my sarcastic English humour. What more could you ask for? And to get this rag, all you have to do is go over to wp-tonic.com/newsletter. WP. You're not typing it, Justin. You should be.
I've got it up here.
Yeah, that's it. I'll always watch our beloved interviewees. How they type the address. wp-tonic.com/newsletter, and you can find it.
Writing it.
Yeah, that's right. Sure, Justin. Over to you, Kirk.
Well, the question that I have is, you know, what would be the biggest mistake that you've made connected with your journey at PicFu? And when I was looking at that question, I couldn't help but think, when did Kung Fu Panda come out? And it came out in 2008, the same year you talked about.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
So maybe it's the name. but what do you think's like the biggest mistake that you could share publicly? Like, hey, this is a learning moment.
Coming on this podcast.
I don't know if I'll give a specific mistake, but I think a common one that we made a couple times that maybe will resonate with others is thinking that a high pedigreed hire or like a high profile consultant will like save the day. Whether that's, I think a lot of times as entrepreneurs, like we're obviously not great at everything. And so you want to bring in someone maybe who's good at sales or good at marketing, or maybe like an all-star designer that you've seen like on stage, and thinking like, oh well, once we get that person, like they'll just come in, they'll figure out they'll understand our business, and they'll make an impact. And I feel like that's almost never paid off, and it's always a really expensive experiment, and it's really disruptive, and it really causes you and the team to kind of like doubt yourselves. It's like, oh well, we brought in this guy, and then like we're trying to like, you know, follow everything that they do, but maybe they just haven't been around. They really don't understand the business, and they're trying to inject their way of doing things, which isn't necessarily what's right for your business. And so, I guess I would just caution people against that. Not that you shouldn't try it, but, you know, just put some guardrails around it. Don't let it be too disruptive. You know, we've allowed people to come in and say like, hey, I'm changing how we're doing everything. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to fire all your people, and I'm going to bring in my own people. And it's like, okay. And then, you know, and then they would leave, and it's like, okay, well, that just disrupted a lot of stuff. And, you know, I guess.
Well, that caused a lot of chaos.
We learned something from it.
A little guy, did it? Right. And then you get the invoice.
Exactly. So, don't allow like the hero, I don't know. I think there's a word for it, but don't allow that savior complex to kind of derail your own journey.
That's pretty dang insightful. I mean, because we could pull some really big names out of the ether and say like, you know, look at Tony Robbins, look at Grant Cardone, look at Dean Graziosi, look at those guys, and everyone goes, oh, they're so successful. I want to be just like them. And it's like, if you injected Grant Cardone's personality into your day to day life, in the position you're in right now, people would beat you in the street, you know? So I always find that kind of stuff interesting. And that's pretty dang insightful.
Must be because I've been living in America now for almost 18 years, but I'm a joint citizen. I'm a US, but for about 40 years of my life, I lived in the UK. And all those names that Kirk mentioned, they've done me personally no harm. But just hearing their names, I just cringe. Everything that those figures represent about American culture just resonates negativity in me. But they're hugely successful and they have this tribe, don't they, Justin?
Yeah. And I think it's entrepreneurs not having the confidence and they're feeling insecure. So they're looking for someone else to give them the path, like, oh, well, you just got to follow this journey or I'm going to come in and I'm going to save your business because I know how to do this and I've done this a million times before. So, I think, you know your business best and, you should have the confidence to take a lot of that data and still hire great people, but don't hand over the reins, so to speak, and just say like, all right, like,
Well, I think it's about what they're doing with, if you want a Facebook campaign and you've got no experience in Facebook hiring, I think educating yourselves and knowing the fundamental elements of running a Facebook campaign so you can make a judgment call. But should you run it? Probably not. Building a website, you probably, if you've got no money, you got to do it. As a startup, you got to do it. But, do you really want, when you get past that stage, do you want to really do a total rebuild or was it best to call somebody in? So I think if there's specific outcomes and a specific skill set that you don't have, I think it's fine. It's when you bring in these general, this savior complex that you mentioned, I think that's when you're going down the wrong road, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a bit odd too, isn't it?
And I definitely echo your point about trying to learn it and try to do it a little bit just so that you have the context of not only hiring that particular individual, but also, being able to talk about their work and judge it a little bit, right? If you've never even seen what a Facebook ad manager looks like, then you may be confused about the things that they're talking about or what they're even doing. So, as an entrepreneur, you might as well try everything. Part of this is the learning experience. And that's what we love about it is just being able to get our hands into all the different aspects of the business because they're fascinating. And you'll try it and you'll be like, all right, I don't want to do this. I'm going to bring someone in to do it. But at least I kind of have a passing understanding. I could talk about it and be a judge if they're doing a good job.
So from a personal savior, let's go on to a technical savior, AI.
Yeah,
AI is going to, going to do everything and save everybody and every quasar semi-failed business model. You just add the words AI to them and then you get investment straight away. So I've been rather cynical today and I not had waffle cup of coffee. So, but seriously, I can see how maybe AI can be very directly linked to your own business. So I would imagine you and your partner and your key people in your company are been having a lot of discussions. I'm only surmising this, but I would have thought so. So maybe you can tell us what your own thoughts are and what kind of discussions you've been having in your own company and how you see it affecting how your own business goes in the next year, 12 months to 18 months, Justin.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think in the very beginning, it was, you had to be cautious with AI, I think, because when it was the first ChatGPT, 3.5 or whatever, I felt like there were a lot more hallucinations and things like
that. Well, I have those every day.
I still think there needs to be caution. And I think maybe people trust AI too much. The way that we like to position ourselves is that while you may be using AI to generate content, you're still selling to actual humans. So you should still get feedback from actual humans. And that is how we would like to pair ourselves with AI. But on within the tool, we're working on building out kind of an AI market research assistant. So you know, right now with the poll results, you might get 50 to 100 or 200 written responses from all these different people. And going through all that individual feedback and kind of distilling out the trends can be quite time consuming. So, you know, we've built in AI summaries and even a way to kind of chat with your poll results and ask it questions based off all that written feedback. And so that's kind of the first step towards having this, you know, assistant, where it used to be someone from our team that would maybe help you or an actual market research consultant, but AI can serve the purpose of that. The next steps would be to build in more AI kind of on the creation side of things. So helping people write the questions and kind of give guidance. And I think the way that business is going to be changing is that there's just an expectation of some base level of AI in every kind of tool now. Because I think it's not so much AI specific tools, but like everything should have some kind of AI, because we all have some kind of data, or we're trying to guide the user through something, and AI can help on all those different things. So, you know, even I was playing with Zapier the other day, and they have, you know, a lot of these tools have a really nice, like, you just tell me what you're trying to do, and they'll guide you, like, oh, cool, use these three blocks. And, you know, like, because like their AI understands all the different components that Zapier can do. And so, you know, if you've got some kind of form of UI in your, you know, in your software, I think there's going to be expectation that AI will be able to help people configure it. If there's some kind of data that you're dealing with, I think there's going to be expectation that AI has some kind of analysis or recommendations based off that data. And then internally, we highly encourage, we've rolled out, you know, ChatGPT Plus to the whole team. And our expectation is that everyone tries to use it for every aspect of their job. And, you know, I think a lot of employers are just expecting people to try to be more productive with it, or I don't know if what the reality of that situation is going to be, but at least experimenting with it, and at least trying to not be fearful of it, right? Like, try to embrace it. And asking, you know, what we encourage is like, just get back to the roots of like your job, even like ask, yeah, like, hey, as you know, as a marketer, as a customer success person, like, what are some things I could be doing, you know, that might be better for my job, or how do I do this? You know, like, obviously for coding, it's great for syntax, great for breaking down problems. So like, really not being shy about it, because there's no one judging you. I mean, the AI may judge you a little bit, but you know, no one's monitoring the queries that you're giving it. And so, you know, it's a private way to get feedback on things. So I mean, instead of looking for Stack Overflow answers, like, go ask AI.
Yeah, that would never save a load of time, would it? Right. Over to you, Kurt.
Well, Justin, it's been a great chat. I get the last question. The last question is, you know, if you had your own time machine, H.G. Wells or a TARDIS from Doctor Who, and you could go back to the start of your business career, you and your partner, what advice would you give yourself?
I think generally to focus on scaling the team and delegating more. And I feel like we've always been, as engineers, and then also really wanting to learn different aspects of the business, like, we've been very hands-on, which I think has been good for the most part, but I think that could be a limiting factor when you feel like you have to be involved in everything, and not empowering other people to kind of like take over when appropriate. So, you know, giving away your Legos, as they say. So I think that would be the broadest theme that would have helped, and would still, you know, still something that we're working on to this day, because even as we scale the team, you know, we tend to be very involved in a lot of day-to-day things, and trying to get out of that is incredibly difficult as a founder. So that would be my advice, or that's what I would change.
That's sound advice. I found myself in the same position with my agency. I was doing everything as a one-man shop. And then I was like, I'm not even good at graphics. Why am I doing graphics? You know, just because I know how doesn't mean I should. So
cool. Exactly. Yeah. And you think you're just going to be faster at it because, like, oh, I already got all the context. Like, I can just whip this out faster than telling someone to do it. But that's not really the point.
No. And I'll just go on record as saying, is if those pictures were an A-B test over your shoulder, I would pick the one that says the narrows.
Nice.
So before we wrap it up, Where are you? Where is the company? You know, if you don't mind me asking, how many people work for you? And if you don't mind me asking, how many paid customers have you got?
So I'm in Los Angeles. My business partner's up in the San Francisco.
No, I mean, how many people work in the company? Sorry.
Oh, we're about 18 people now, fully remote, full-time people. Like I said, all over all over LATAM, Europe, and the globe. Paying customers is kind of difficult because it's usage-based. And so like we have people kind of coming back and like, you know, maybe they're authors and they come back every year because they write a new ebook or something like that. But yeah, we definitely have helped thousands of different customers across all the different industries. Yeah. And we've grown in a self-funded way.
It's been a great discussion. I think we've covered a load of stuff. So Justin, what's the best way for people to find out more about you and more about PickFu?
LinkedIn is probably the best way. So you could find me, Justin Chen, on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active there. And then if you want to check out PickFu, PickFu.com, you can sign up.
Yeah, let me ask you, what was the path to that led to the name, actually, Justin?
So it didn't have to do with Kung Fu Panda, but it was related.
Oh, that's a shame. I thought that was quite a good story, actually. That was, don't you create a story, say that you did it for that. That would be
well, so Fu, we did take the Fu suffix because it's like the mastery of something. And we wanted something that was, it was like the something really good at picking something for you, picking for you also, which works, pick for you. And then it was just really short at the time. And, you know, Twitter was coming out. We wanted short URLs so people could share them. And we like that it could be a verb. So, you know, we have a lot of customers saying that they pick food it when they don't know which option to do. So it's worked out. It's very memorable. It stops a lot of people. And they're like, wait, what is that? Tell me what that is. Or are you just cussing at me? So, you know, it's a good conversation starter.
Well, this is pronounceable. We have people that have company names and I practice them consistently before the show. And the more I practice, Justin, the worse my pronunciation gets. And it's hilarious that I can't even pronounce the name of their company. So, but I take it in good cheer, actually. Because Justin, it's been a great discussion. I really enjoyed it. We've got some great guests coming up, folks. I've got some great conversations. We will be back next week. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. Why not visit the Mastermind Facebook group? And also to keep up with the latest news, click wp-tonic.com/newsletter. We'll see you next time.